Talk given Friday, 5th January, 1979. You may recollect that at our last meeting, we considered this point, that the supreme fulfillment of man could be expressed in terms like these, that it consists in the realization of the eternal silence. It's very easy to use phrases like this, but whatever phrase we use has always a misleading element in it. Because the words are supposed to stand for that which belongs to a much profounder dimension of being and consciousness, which we can never know with our brains, which implies that the intellect, as it functions here in us during our waking life, using speech and conceptual thinking as its instruments for knowledge, is quite unable to reach or to touch. And yet, the intellect, the perceptiveness with which we are endowed, can be stimulated. We may put it in these terms, that we may get an inspiration. There may be such an influence, a new influence, come into our whole being, the inner depths of the mind as such, that we are able to grow inwardly in awareness of a reality and in wisdom. Wisdom which actually has nothing to do with knowledge. Knowledge in the ordinary sense is often an obstruction. In fact, all too often an obstruction to wisdom, to the growth of that profounder intelligence which is dormant in all of us, which sees the truth of things in a manner and a fashion which is quite outside the realm of speech and conceptual thought. And yet, this is what we have to accept always, every day, every moment, as our starting point. Sometimes people are... They smile when I say, I'm always beginning, never proceed. But to take the first step means to have the urge to grow into that which we may say is part of man's destiny on this planet. And if such inspiration helps us, well, we have not wasted our life energy. Now today, in connection with what we did last time, let us try and understand in greater depth, if it is possible for us to do so, if it is possible for me to speak about such things less and less misleadingly, let us try to understand some of the deep implications of this realization of the eternal silence. Without the functioning of our senses and the use of our faculty of speech, we would have no perception of the body, of the whole of the psychophysical organism. Our tendency during the last couple of thousand years has been to regard the body as something different from the soul, the mind, or the spirit. Now, body is not different from the mind. The living person as such is very definitely a body-mind organism. Hyphenate the two words, body and mind. He is very definitely that. And the tendency in some people to say that the mind is more important, and in other people to say that the body is more important, is a misleading tendency altogether. You can't compare their relative importance. Take the body as we ordinarily talk of it, in the ordinary sense. We have a heart, we have lungs, we have a brain. Can we possibly compare the importance of heart and brain? No heart, no living person. No brain, no living person. No lungs, no living person, and so on. So this, which we call body-mind, but which more accurately should be called body-psyche, we are a psychophysical organism. This is a single organism as such. But if there were no senses functioning, receiving impressions from outside, and if there were no brain coordinating those sensations, and utilizing symbolic sounds, that is, language, to represent that synthesizing of those impressions, we would not be conscious of body at all. So, because the psyche, the mind if you like to call it, plays a dominant role in the whole story of our perception and the growth of our understanding of ourselves, the way we function, and that towards which the whole human race is evolving. I'm using the word evolving in both the biological and in the psychological sense, growing towards some fulfillment. Because the psyche plays the more important part in this sense only, because it is the representative, the receptacle of the mental processes that go on in us, the emotional and the intellectual processes. Therefore, we must be very sensitive to the fact that it is the sensuous experience of the body that enables us to experience the body at all and say, this is the body. You see, now this is perhaps specifically Hindu-Buddhistic as far as the analysis of the living organism is concerned. There may be other cultures which do not feel inclined to regard the body as a mental phenomenon simply because it is sensuously perceived. But I think we will find it helpful from the religious point of view to regard it as such. Now, it's this perception of the body as the body and the functioning of our senses in the perception of the functioning of the senses in our limited way makes us regard the psychophysical organism as a separate self. This is one of the main roots of the trouble with human beings. Because we regard ourselves as separate selves, and because each one of us has his own specific desires and ambitions, his particular physical constitution, brain, nerves, ductus glands, and so on and so on, we tend to cut ourselves off from the rest of the world. We have a very powerful, vivid sense of self. I am I. And a very dim sense of what we call the other fellow. Have we ever tried as an experiment to put ourselves consciously, suddenly to transplant our consciousness, our self-consciousness, into our neighbor or our wife or husband or son or friend or someone we dislike or anything? Have we ever tried to do that? If we just try to do it quietly, we will find it is practically impossible to know that other person in the manner that we know ourselves. Take, for instance, our own muscle sense, so that we feel our own body and we know this is the body and we know what the body feels like and is like and so forth. Now, what does the other person's body feel like? What do the other person's emotions and thoughts feel like or look like? We can't really do that. The content in the psyche, in the mind of the other person is very much a closed book. He will use words conversing with us. We understand it and interpret what he says according to the dictionary meaning of the words. And our interpretation, if we look at it carefully, is always limited by our own conditioning, our own conceptions. What is there in his mind when he has said just those words? I mean, it's all right if it's some algebraical equation which has only that definite specific meaning. It has just that, and perhaps the point about the content of his mind and the content of my mind doesn't influence the understanding so much. But in all ordinary things, we think we have heard what he said, what he feels, and we come to our own conclusions and so forth. And they are far short of what actually was in that person's psyche. So you see, we are separate, desperately separate. And since the drive of our life energy is towards the satisfaction of our own desires, the gratification of our own ambitions and so forth, we obtrude ourselves upon the world. Now, this obtrusion of the self upon the world is the meaning of noise in the religious context. If and when there are individuals, there is one individual or several individuals who are the fulfilled, perfected holy ones, they will act, they will speak, they will make sounds like any of us do, but the quality of that which they do will never be obtrusive upon the world, because they are completely free of the sense of separate selfness. It is this which we have to deal with essentially in the process of our religious living and what we call our spiritual growth. So, this perceiving and regarding the psychophysical organism as a separate self introduces disharmony into the whole, into the totality. And therefore, we cannot hear the silence of eternity, which is the song of life. That's why I'm deliberately using these phrases. We cannot hear the silence of eternity, which is the song of life. There is a divine, transcendent seeing and hearing and touching and tasting, which does not introduce a wrong note into the symphony of the cosmic process. I said a divine seeing, hearing, touching, tasting, etc. But you and I can only use those words which exhaust our particular modes of functioning, seeing, hearing, touching, tasting, etc. There may be many, many other modes which are closed books to us, because we, constituting mankind, are so constructed that we are limited to these five senses, physically, and to the psychical process, which of course in the East is always regarded as material, not immaterial. Not pure mind, mind which is matter, thought particularly, and emotions and so forth. Because it's entirely tied up with the past, with the time process, with what is already known. And therefore, that is not the realm of pure mind whence comes new creation. There is no such thing as new creation from us. We say that the works of the great artists and scientists are creative works. But actually, they are procreative works for the very simple reason that they are true to type. Whatsoever is true to type is related to the past. It's a procreative transmission from one to the other. The greatest artists procreate. If you take the forms of poetry or music or any such thing, they have grown out of a past. There is no absolute pulse of creation at work there, producing the new. But this is a reality, a fundamental fact, which one can realize when there is the complete religious fulfillment. We have no conception of what religious fulfillment means. We have very, very limited ideas about it. For us, silence means the complete ending of the intrusion by selfness into the totality. Then we are truly integral part and parcel of totality. Totality is not different from us. We are not different from totality. It is not merely a case of the totality containing us, sustaining us, and so forth, but we contain and sustain the totality. This, of course, no brain can grasp. How is it that the atom contains the entire cosmos? But it does. We function in three dimensions of time, three dimensions of space, wedded to one dimension of time. But is there only one dimension of time? Are there only three dimensions of space? Are there modes of awareness which are completely transcendent to our present mode of awareness? But in that transcendent mode, our mode is entirely subsumed. It's a fragment of that totality. It's a microcosmic fragment of that totality. Now, separate self, the I am I consciousness, born of sense perception of the body, is tied up with space, time, matter, consciousness. Which means it is confined to time as far as the living process, the growth process is concerned, and therefore to mortality. Because growth means change. There's no meaning to growth apart from change, perpetual change. But the actual nature of this change is similar to the pulse of creation, which the old people called a life-death pulse, but as you have often heard me say, I prefer to call a life-other-life pulse. Being, non-being, finitude, infinity, mortality, immortality. Now this change takes place with incredible rapidity. Our consciousness can't keep pace with it. But supposing our consciousness could keep pace with it, what happens? The distinction between birth and death, that is to say, the manner in which we are aware of that event we call birth and the event we call death, would undergo complete transformation. And we'd be aware only in terms of transformation. Life is eternal. It never began. There is no such thing as proceeding in space-time terms, which are terms of limitation. It is the absolute. It is eternal. Now, if you ask a person what eternity means, if you look in the dictionary for the meaning of eternity, you will see the idea presented that it is the opposite of time. Eternity is not the opposite of time. And there are those, and they are the many few, curious phrase to use, but they are the many few who identify it with timelessness. Because you and I, human beings, can experience timelessness. And we say that in that state, this is eternity. It is not. Haven't you noticed that in all the great scriptural writings, in the writings of the mystics and so forth, they talk of the moments of timelessness? That is to say, the psychophysical organism in that particular state experiences the cessation of time. It is at one with this pulse of creation. There are no thoughts, feelings, actions as in the sense in which we are conscious of them here and now. None at all. There is no process of decay of the body in the period of timelessness. Now look at the language that is used, the period of timelessness. But you see, any language we use in connection with the word timeless or timelessness is always circumscribed by time, a beginning and an ending. So that in our innermost awareness, we are not aware of, we have not completely woken up to the eternal. But timelessness, as experienced by us, is on the way to that eternity. Now, if attentiveness and observation, in attentiveness, there is complete awareness. That's what I mean by observation. Complete awareness. Not observation in the sense of I, an observing subject. Observing the observed object. Not in that sense. But in the sense of complete awareness, being the thing. That I have said again and again. That the culmination of such attentiveness, such awareness, that you are that of which you are, that which you are attentive to. You are that thing, in consciousness. Not physically, of course, but in consciousness. The separation between self and not self is completely out. You see? So now, if attentiveness and observation of things, of essences, dharmas is the word in the Mahayana Buddhism, and beyond both of these, because you can realize that state of attentiveness in our period of timelessness. If then our attentiveness and observation can be total and constant, total and constant, not constant merely in the sense of a time continuity, but vibrating here now, in the here now, the space-time integration, here, now, space, time, integration. If it is there continuously like that, then awareness is total awareness, total being. It is the whole, the absolute. You see how difficult words are? But we cannot consider things like this without talking. And of course we are immediately constricted by the limitations upon the brain activity and speech and concepts and so forth. Now, when that awareness being is the whole, that is the immortal. That is the eternal. The differentiated and the undifferentiated are an inextricable whole. They are not separate. This is the real meaning of nirvana, of the absolute. You may use anything you like. You may use the word that the English philosopher Hamilton used, the unconditioned. Now, see this. If we can see this, our values in our everyday life, which are invariably sullied by selfness, either in its gross forms, which is universal with all mankind, or even in its subtlest forms. It's extraordinary how this sense of selfness goes right the way through to the very end. Our values vanish. And yet we have to use words, the positive, acceptable words, like love and truth and beauty and goodness and so forth, to talk about it. Otherwise we can't talk about it at all. If we ourselves are utterly purified, the psyche, that means, is empty of all fixations in terms of concepts, beliefs, convictions, memories, and so forth. That is to say, the limiting effect of memories. If the psyche is entirely free of that, and entirely free of a drive with the self's benefit or aggrandizement or whatever it is involved in it, then we will find that at this stage all our ordinary values have vanished, because we are one with the total process. And in the total process there is no such thing as process, as progress, as purpose. How can totality have a purpose with respect to itself? Purpose is something which applies to this in relationship to that, the other. But where that otherness has vanished by virtue of awareness, consciousness being complete and whole, then there is no such thing as purpose. There is no such thing as acceptance or rejection. All that goes out. There is no problem of good and evil. You see, there is no question of choice involved there. Then, when that has happened, our senses, these very physical senses, whose activity, coupled with speech in our waking state, was the starting point of all the suffering, the sorrow, the confusion, the ignorance, the misery of mankind started. These very senses have truly become the cords of communion. Now, be careful. When I say cords of communion, I do not mean communion between myself and an other. Whether you call that other God as a person or as an absolute or a philosophical idea or any such thing, it doesn't mean that. The senses are, of course, this is the terrible difficulty of language, because you always get the separative element involved with every word. The senses are the universal conduits. They are not separate conduits. They are separate conduits, so to say, and at the same time each one is the one and only conduit. And the conduit is the whole universe itself. Now we are in a nice old pickle with words. But this is the kind of thing that happens, actually happens. They are cords of communion. And in that sense, that communion means that the wholeness of all levels of being, of all octaves of consciousness, is one unbroken holiness. It is, in fact, transcendence itself. If one can let the whole of the psyche, and particularly the brain and its activity, be quiet, be truly quiet, then one will appreciate why the great Brahmanical teachers of the Upanishads dared to use a phrase like Aham Brahmasmi. I am Brahman, the Absolute. I mean, on the face of it, it stands as the most astoundingly egoistic statement ever made by man. And yet, all the great mystics do, whether they were theistic mystics or non-theistic mystics, they have all said that in some form or other. And of course the language is always misleading unless and until you yourself have somehow penetrated into that mystery through the complete dissolution of separate selfness in one's own consciousness. This is the important point. The whole story of religious development, of spiritual fulfillment, of the fulfillment of the purpose of our existence and all that, is a complete transformation of our mode of awareness from the limited, finite, mortal mode into the infinite, immortal, eternal mode. Then it is no longer our consciousness. It is the one and only total consciousness itself which functions through you. If you are a devotee by nature, you'll use phrases like this, that God functions freely through his servant. You see, it's like that. Now, when the senses are the living cords of communion, they function continuously through all time. the whole day. Whether you're asleep, whether you're awake, makes no difference. They function continuously in that manner as cords of communion. But in that sort of communion, and remember, it is a communion in which the wholeness of all levels of being and of all octaves of consciousness is one unbroken holiness. Then every action taking place through us is in true harmony with the divine creative process, the very pulse of creation, the cosmic process. And if one can be aware of this, even in the slightest possible measure, then one knows the meaning of the word cosmos. Now, this is the sort of thing that the deeps of religion have attempted to teach. That is to say, to present to those who are seriously interested. This is the meaning of yoga. You have had several meanings of yoga during these years, but you can put it in these terms too. This is yoga. The real yoga. Now, those who are interested in Buddhism, especially in Mahayana Buddhism, who have some knowledge or acquaintance with works like the Prajnaparamita and Buddhist philosophy in general. Take for instance the Vajracchedika, the Diamond Sutra, as it is called, because it is adamantine. It is absolutely crystal clear, like the perfect diamond. And it is hard. The hardness not signifying hardness in the sense of the hard heart or the hard nature or any such thing. But that which cannot be destroyed, the indestructible, the self-subsistent, an absolute aseity existing on its own, undependent, nondescript. See, if you look at some of those things in the Diamond Sutra, you will find extraordinary statements which are utterly baffling. Now, the Buddha gives an exposition of dharma. To Subhuti, his foremost disciple who had realized peace, foremost in that direction. There were several other foremost disciples in other directions. Subhuti asked, "What then, O Lord, is this discourse on dharma, and how should I bear it in mind?" The Lord replied, "This discourse on dharma, Subhuti, is called wisdom which has gone beyond, and as such should you bear it in mind." And why? Just that which the Tathagata, that is the Buddha himself, has taught as the wisdom which has gone beyond, just that he has taught has not gone beyond. Therefore, is it called wisdom which has gone beyond? Now, any clever schoolboy with a logical brain, as we would say, oh, what piffle. For him it is piffle, because he doesn't understand what on earth is attempted to be presented in these words. Just that which the Tathagata has taught as the wisdom which has gone beyond, just that he has taught as not gone beyond. Therefore, is it called wisdom which has gone beyond? When one attempts to convey the transcendent, time, space, matter have vanished. You are dealing with that in which time, space, matter have no influence, no limiting influence upon the mode in which you are aware. So if you say the wisdom which has gone beyond, naturally the other person says, this is a profounder knowledge than what was presented before. It isn't. Because once you touch totality, it is totality. It is the beyond, if we look at it from the standpoint of the non-totality, from the limited point of view, from the point of view of a mortal functioning of intellect and consciousness and so forth. But in immortality, what is beyond? In eternity, what is not beyond? So, therefore, is it called wisdom which has gone beyond? Why is it called that? Because we have no option but to use that phrase in our limited terms. Now, if you grasp, get a reasonably good glimmer of that, you will understand the profounder meaning which you find in the Theravada teachings, the so-called lesser vehicle, the Hinayana, where the different samapattis, the jhanas and samapattis, the different grades of consciousness as we commonly call them, are listed. When you get to the universal scale of the infinity of akasha, manifestation, vijnana, consciousness, and then what is called the state of no thing. Now, remember, we are talking of infinity, immortality, therefore. We are not talking of the limited, the particular. Therefore, all our thinking and conceiving, which is confined to the limited and the particular, cannot grasp that in our terms. That state of the no-thing is the absolute everything. The plenitude is the void. This plenitude is void of limitation, void of evil, void of suffering, void of ignorance, and so forth. That's what it is void of. But it is the plenitude, the pulse of creation itself. And then the next, the eighth, the fourth samapatti, that is, four jhanas, four samapattis. The eighth one is called the plane of neither perception nor non-perception. Now, the word perception here is used in both senses. Perception in terms of the realm of limitation. Non-perception meaning you do not perceive limitation. And then there is what the Mahayana would call the true perception. So these apparently contradictory statements, which are so tiresome and difficult to understand, one begins to get some light as to what they really mean. But you see, the whole starting point, the senses, speech, limitation. And then to bear in mind that as you free yourself from all this through pure attentiveness, mindfulness, that's the whole thing, from beginning to end, the whole technique of yoga, of religion, of anything you like, is this being aware of the totality all the time. Just being attentive. See? When that reaches its climax, then you are freed from all limitation. And one of the supreme purposes of life, of the universal process in bringing man into being, has been fulfilled through that individual by the totality, by the absolute, by God, use what word you like.